if you are struggling, to reach out and know that your life has value and your life has worth and your life has meaning, even if the depression or the darkness is telling you something different.
Happiness, success, freedom, energy, fun, balance, strength, peace. It all stems from our physical and emotional well-being. You're in the right place for a healthy discussion with experts to show you the way. This is Be Well, a podcast from Crossover Health. Not sick is not enough. Being well is a movement to get the most we want out of life. In each of our episodes, we pick a health or lifestyle topic, bring in one of our doctors from the front lines, and have a real conversation. Be well, do good, enjoy life.
What's up, everyone? This is Dan Lord, Program Director for Crossover Health. You're in the right place for a healthy discussion. Today, we will be talking about suicide and suicide prevention. Suicide is a sensitive topic. If this topic is triggering for you, please consider whether or not listening to this podcast is healthy for you at this time. If you choose to listen, consider listening with someone you trust, or after listening, talking with someone you trust, or a mental health provider. This episode is not intended to be a substitute for professional mental health diagnosis or advice or treatment from a qualified mental health provider. If you are feeling suicidal, have a plan to take your life, are thinking about hurting yourself, or are worried that someone you know may be in danger of hurting themselves, please call 911 or call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. The Lifeline provides 24/7 free and confidential support for people in distress and prevention and crisis resources for you and your loved one. With me today, I have two special guests, Sierra Melinder, licensed clinical social worker and mental health therapist, who currently works as a therapist at Crossover in San Bernardino, California, and a returning guest, Michael Boroff, a clinical psychologist who currently oversees Crossover's mental health program, while also seeing a small number of patients for therapy.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. You know, as a psychologist over the years, I've had a lot of experience with people dealing with thoughts of suicide, and also people who've lost loved ones to suicide, and that includes all the way down to kids as young as 5, 6 years old, up through the range of adults, and I've worked with people who've lost loved ones to suicide and have unfortunately had patients that I've worked with commit suicide as well. So it's a topic that I have a lot of familiarity with, and it's a really important one. Our suicide rate in this country is still quite high, and it's really an important thing for us to talk about. So really glad to be here.
So I've been a licensed social worker working in mental health for quite some time now. And similar experience to Michael, you know, working with patients who are struggling with thoughts of suicide themselves or have had lost loved ones to suicide. Ages range, you know, in adult, especially teens and early adolescents and 20-year-olds, all the way up to older adults to about the end of life age, dealing with chronic illness. So I think Michael and I both have had a variety of experience.
It's so great to have both of you from different perspectives talk about this really important and challenging topic. Michael, I'd love for you to kind of get us started on the bigger picture on what you think people should really know about suicide.
Yeah, you know, I think as a starting point, I would just say that thoughts about suicide are more common than I think any of us would ever realize. And it's something that, you know, as therapists, we see a lot of people who are struggling with depression, trauma, anxiety. These thoughts come up often. And I think oftentimes people feel ashamed or a number of thoughts and feelings around those, but just kind of normalizing it as a starting point.
Absolutely. As mental health professionals, we see this often. And I think suicide and thoughts of suicide are not something that is limited to a certain gender or identity or people group or race or ethnicity, but anyone can struggle with this. In 2020, actually 1.4 million people actually attempted suicide. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. There are specific populations that can be at higher risk. Veterans, a study was done in 2017 that showed that they're at a 1.5 higher percent of being at risk for suicide. As I said, you know, suicide is something that is common. It's not specific to certain people or race or gender or ethnicity, but anyone can struggle with this.
Yeah, you're hearing it being the 10th leading cause of death. And I think if we look at younger groups, it's the second leading cause of death amongst teens. It's just happening a lot. I think it was over 43,000 suicides in 2019. So we're just still seeing so much of it. And seeing the demographics change a little bit, it used to be that the thought that kind of middle-aged men were at greater risk for it, middle-aged white men in particular, and we're seeing increases in some other populations as well, including people of color and other folks who, you know, we're seeing higher rates. And so I really want to take this seriously. I was just going to speak a little bit to, you know, my experience working with folks who are struggling with these thoughts. And I think it can be really hard to understand from people who haven't necessarily experienced it. I think when people get in that place where they're thinking about suicide, there's such a darkness there. And suicide and depression can make things seem completely reasonable to them that don't seem that way to other people. And some of those thoughts can include, you know, people would be better off without me. Nobody would miss me if I'm gone. The only way to get rid of this pain I'm feeling is to not be here anymore. And that's certainly something I've heard from people who've attempted and lived on, is that it's not that they wanted to die. It's that they just didn't want to feel what they were feeling anymore. And that seemed like the only way out. And so I think, you know, that there's just so much pain wrapped up in that people are just trying to figure out a way to escape from. You know, it's a horrible way to feel. And I think, again, it's hard to understand if you haven't lived it.
You know, I think that the darkness is a really good analogy, and something that I talk with, you know, my patients about, is that it can kind of feel like sometimes you're in like a cave, you know, you're just in this dark place and there's kind of just darkness all around you. And so, you know, that's why reaching out for help is a really good thing, whether starting therapy or even just letting someone know. Because like I said, the analogy that I use is kind of like this dark cave, and then we're just shining a flashlight in there. You know, we're just kind of illuminating, giving some light to what's going on. A lot of the time there's stuff, hard stuff underneath, big life changes, a death, a job loss. And there are a lot of things that can contribute to it, which is why therapy and reaching out for help can be so important, because you're really exploring what's causing it. And what I believe as a therapist is, you know, it's not what's wrong with you, it's what's happened to you. Trauma from the past, current life stressors, things that are really causing or driving us to a place where we feel like there is no solution but ending your life. And so, yeah, we want to help people see that there's hope, that things will get better.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point, Sierra. And you know, I think part of what happens when people are in that dark place is it feels like nothing's going to help. And, you know, just really want to emphasize that we can help. You know, I think suicide is final. There's no taking it back. And there's so many other options to try to help things get better, and really want to encourage people to do that. There still is so much stigma around mental health, and sometimes people feel like you know, they have all sorts of fears about actually talking to somebody about the thoughts they're having. But just really want to reinforce what you said, Sierra, that please ask for help. Both you and I, Sierra, mentioned that we've worked with loved ones who've lost people to suicide. It's always hard measuring people's pain, but the feelings that are left of loved ones who've lost people to suicide, feelings of guilt, that why didn't they see it coming? They you know, they should have done more. It's a pain that just never really heals for people. And you know, if anybody's listening who's struggling with these thoughts of suicide, just really wanting to understand that people do care about you. And it's, no matter what depression is telling you, no matter what these thoughts are telling you, it will have a really significant impact on the people who are left behind if you're not here anymore. I want you to know that.
You know, seeing that kind of, like you said, the aftermath of it, of people who have lost loved ones. And I think that was kind of what you said in regards to a wound or a hole that can't really be filled. I echo Michael that if you are struggling, yeah, to reach out and know that your life has value and your life has worth and your life has meaning, even if the depression or the darkness is telling you something different. We want to be here to kind of shine that light of, like, you have value and there's purpose for your life.
One question I have is, what are some of the barriers to seeking help? Michael, you mentioned stigma, but, you know, how do we shine that light in a better way? Or what are the barriers to shining that light in the cave?
Yeah, I think there are a number of reasons why people don't ask for help. Thinking about stigma, there's this belief that, hey, if I see a therapist, that means I'm crazy, that there's something horribly wrong with me, and I can't tolerate that. There are cultural barriers to it, and that still therapy is still very much a taboo in a number of cultures. People may prefer, like, hey, that in my culture, we go to our faith leaders around mental health issues and crises, and that's okay too. And we can certainly incorporate faith into treatment and really want people to know that. If that's an important part of your value system, we'll certainly incorporate that into the help that we give. Speaking as a man, I think men often feel like they need to carry the world on their shoulders on their own, that it's a sign of weakness to have to ask for help. We don't get a lot of practice or role modeling around being vulnerable and talking about what we're feeling. And we do know that men complete suicide at a much higher rate than women do in the US. So I think that there's potentially some sex issues around that as well. And just really would speak to men and just say, like, hey, it's never too late to try this. And yeah, it may feel uncomfortable. Again, we're here to help and really want to be able to do that.
Yeah, I would say something that kind of came to mind is even really knowing how to get help, I think, is a barrier. Because sometimes people recognize, okay, I'm not doing well. Where do I go? Where do I even start to kind of figure out how to get myself better? So I'd say that's a pretty big barrier I've seen as well, which is why I love Crossover, because we are here. We are a part of the treatment team right along with primary care services. So I would say that's a big, big barrier as well I've seen.
I think sometimes people worry that, like, we might force them in some way to take medications. I certainly hear that too. And people have that concern. And, mm-hmm. just kind of let people know that medications are an option. That's something for you to decide and consent to. I think for people who are experiencing really deep depression, I often recommend that as part of a treatment plan, but it really is up to you, and nobody's going to ever force you to take medications. So just want to make that really clear for folks as well.
I think that's a really good point you bring up, Michael, in regards to, because I think when people hear mental health, due to their own experience or what they've seen on social media or, knowing someone who's taken medication, I think that heavily really gets tied to therapy itself, when in the reality, they're kind of two separate treatments. And if needed, both can definitely be integrated in together. But just because you go to therapy doesn't mean we are giving you medication. It's something you have to take.
Maybe people who are listening who've never been to therapy before, Sarah, maybe you want to speak to, like, what would therapy look like? How would therapy help somebody who's struggling with depression, thoughts of suicide?
Yeah, I think, the word that you used, Michael, is that we can help find a solution. As providers, I don't believe in just filtering someone kind of through, okay, we're going to do this, 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 and this. We're sticking you through a regimen, and then we're kind of spitting you out at the end. As each person is unique, treatment and how we approach things will be unique to you as well. Therapy is really great because the way that I describe it to patients who have never been to therapy before, of this is a place where you can come and just kind of exhale out. This is a place where you have the complete freedom to be yourself. In society, we have jobs and different that type of stuff, and we sometimes can feel like we have to present in a certain way or say a certain thing or just feel forced into a box. And so I always encourage patients from the first session is, hey, this is a place to just come and fully be yourself. Everything that you're feeling, like, is welcome, and I encourage that to be expressed. And so therapy can be good because as mental health professionals, we've gone through training of, okay, how do we instill hope? How do we, talk about coping skills or things to practically apply to help with depression? How can we work through things that have happened in the past traumas, to work through those? So I think therapy is really great because we can offer tools and skills that patients can apply to their lives to help them start feeling better.
Yeah, you know, I think the first is really understanding, and anybody that any therapist you're going to work with is going to want to build a relationship with you and build trust. And I think particularly when you're in that place of hopelessness, that trust becomes really, really important.
Right.
And then, you know, in terms of the types of strategies we use, you know, and I mentioned earlier some of the kind of thoughts that are really common for people who are struggling with thoughts of suicide around their own worth and value, and just things that are have become distorted in the darkness. And so helping people look at kind of more balanced ways of thinking about things, looking at the evidence, and then also thinking about their own values, what's important to them, and how can they make choices that line up with those values. If your loved ones are really important to you, if that's a really strong value you have, what sorts of decisions will help you kind of live that value? And I find that people really often connect to that approach as well. You know, we all have things that are incredibly important to us, and we tend to feel our best when we're making decisions in a way that lines up with those values, but we don't really spend time consciously thinking about that. And so sometimes having those conversations can really help and help point towards the solutions you were talking about, Sierra, in terms of getting people into a better place.
What should our, you know, message be to loved ones? Because this could be just a tremendously challenging situation to deal with. You know, whether somebody's in contemplation, it has depression, or going through some of the aftermath. Mm-hmm. What's our message to the loved ones involved in these situations?
As a loved one, is to listen. And I think the big message is to remind them that you care. You know, as Michael said earlier, feelings of hopelessness or feeling like people won't miss me if I take my life, that reminding them that you care and that you're there. You know, I think it's also important to encourage them and help support them in getting professional help. You know, I think sometimes as a loved one, we really want to be supportive. And sometimes we feel that it's our responsibility to kind of take on the burden, take on what's going on. But I would just encourage those people to support and encourage them to encourage that person to get professional help. But I think the biggest thing is that letting someone know that you're there and that you care is the big thing.
Yeah, I think those caring messages are really important. I think oftentimes our tendency is to try and fix. And I think in those moments, what people often need is just listening and acceptance. And that can be so hard because it can feel so scary hearing somebody you care about with these thoughts. But the last thing you want to do is shut them down because of your own response in those moments. And it's a lot to ask. Loved ones are not trained therapists, and they have their own emotions going on and fears and anger and all sorts of feelings that come up for loved ones who are kind of dealing with this. But I think that's why helping them to get help from professionals is another really, really important thing to do. I think one of the other pieces that I wanted to talk about today, and I know this can get to be a hot topic and become something that can be seen as a political issue, and I really want to move that to the side and just talk about the realities. One of the biggest risks to people completing suicide is having firearms in the home and having easy access to a firearm. There are more suicides by firearm each year than there are homicides overall in the United States. And it is by far the most lethal means of suicide. And so if you have a loved one in a home who is experiencing suicidal thinking, please lock up any guns in the home. Make sure that they do not know the codes to the safe. There's a way within your state's laws to get the guns out of the home for a while until the crisis passes. This is one of the best things you can do. And similarly, if you're dealing with thoughts of suicide and there is a gun in the home, this is a way you can ask for help from your loved ones. It's like, hey, can you please get this gun locked up in a safe? You know the code. I don't. But removing that as an option is something really, really important that loved ones can do.
Yeah. And it's just to kind of tag on to that, if you aren't able to lock them in a safe at home, depending on the state you're in, you can actually go to a police station, or some gun stores will actually hold on to your guns as well. So feeling like the person does know the gun safe code, or if you feel like, okay, we want to take them out of the home and we don't have a friend or someone else that we can. According to different states, either a police station or like a local gun store can hold those for you.
Thanks for bringing that up, Sierra. I think those are great solutions too. That may feel vulnerable, and to some people it may even feel like, hey, this is infringing on my rights. But just understanding that the risk associated with having it in the home is a really big deal, and we're really recommending this out of care and concern. So just really want you thinking about that.
Yeah. You know, because I think what Michael's trying to say is focus on a place of safety as opposed to not trying to cross over into violating anyone's rights, but encouraging safety in somebody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear any other solutions or tactics or strategies that you could tell our listeners.
We talked a little bit about the kind of the darkness, and one of the things that can be really helpful is trying to focus on where the bright spots are. And so gratitude can be a really healthy practice. What are some things? And sometimes it can be really small. Like, I have a roof over my head. I'm grateful for the fact that I have a place to stay. I have one person who I know cares about me. Don't judge what it is, but just noticing things that are positives. And I think shifting that focus away from that darkness to bright spots can be really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, talking about, you know, you had mentioned earlier kind of the values and the things that are important to you, and really what's, I think it's important to focus on, like, what's giving us hope, even if it's, you know, a loved one or even a pet. The connection with a pet or an animal is very, very powerful. Those things can give us hope, and hope is a very, very powerful tool. A lot of the time in depression and suicide, things feel very hopeless. So talking about and building hope is something that I think is very important as clinicians, as we're working with people who feel very hopeless. And so there's so much extensive research that talks about the power of hope. There's so many studies that are done on believing that something can get better, because that's what hope is. If we're kind of going to define that, it's not like a wishful thinking, but it's believing that things can get better. And it's kind of broken down into three ways of acknowledging like a goal and having agency, which is believing that we can do it, believing that we have the ability to make something happen, even if it's just a very small step. Okay, I can do this, even if it's just getting out of bed. You know, I believe that I can get out of bed today and take that small agency step. And then also having a pathway, which is talking about the route that we get there. So hope is built on those three things, and I think can be a very powerful tool in life and, you know, and in getting better.
You know, one thing that I would add on to that is one of the things I've done professionally is run what are called intensive outpatient program groups. And sometimes that's something we refer people to get them even more services. You know, a therapist maybe sees you for once a week for 45 minutes. IOP program can see you 3 to 4 days a week for many hours. And one of the things I've seen really create hope is seeing other people get better. And in a program like that, where you actually see people, and that can feel very vulnerable, like other people kind of knowing your business, but actually seeing people find that light at the end of the tunnel, get into a better place. Some of the most powerful hope-causing events I've ever seen have happened in programs like that. So something else that a therapist might recommend to you.
Just kind of to tag along on that, you know, in the group setting, that helps build like a connection with other people. When we feel depressed and hopelessness, isolation can really tag onto that. So the importance of building relationships, having social interaction, engaging with our coworkers, our peers around us is also very important to our well-being, and especially in regards to this topic, I would say.
So kind of talking directly to our listeners and maybe someone who's having an issue right now, going through some challenges right now, what are kind of your key messages for them? What do you want them to take away?
Yeah, you know, I think if you are struggling with suicide or thoughts of suicide, to definitely, like we had said earlier, to reach out. We do have the National Suicide Hotline posted, so that is a really great step They have a trained counselor available 24/7 for someone to talk to. You know, another good resource to reach out for mental health is starting with your primary care doctor. You know, your primary can definitely refer you or get you connected somewhere. Here at Crossover, you know, we offer, you know, mental health services right along with primary. And then also kind of just a practical tip that if you know someone who maybe isn't associated with Crossover, you can, that person can actually call their insurance companies and they can get them connected to mental health that's covered by their insurance. I've come across many people that didn't know that. They just thought that their insurance was just for like primary care health, but your insurance also does, depending on the plan, they do offer, you know, mental health connections as well.
Yeah. I agree with everything you said, Sierra. I think just getting help from professionals who know how to guide you through these struggles and get you into a better place. We're here and you know, if you give us that chance, I think you'll realize you can trust us and you know, we really, really do care.
Yeah, we really do care. And we really want to see people get better and to do whatever we can to help people get better and to feel better. Absolutely.
Thanks so much. The resources and phone numbers mentioned will be listed in the show notes for anybody that needs it. Michael, Sierra, thank you so much for your time. Thanks so much for sharing and talking about this important subject.
Anyone 18 or over in the United States can be a Crossover Health member. At Crossover, you stay connected to a care team that works together and gets to know you over time. A doctor, a nurse, a mental health expert, a physical therapist, a chiropractor, a health coach, a fitness coach, and a care navigator. Go to crossoverhealth.com to join the healthcare revolution. If you like our podcast, please follow or subscribe and leave a review. If you have a topic you want us to explore, let us know on Facebook or Instagram at Crossover Health. Until next time, be well.